Hi everybody, I'm Raj Mago. I'm here with Dr. Jack Krasuski, who is Executive Director of the American Physician Institute. And Dr. Krasuski is here in Philadelphia to do a lecture about suicide prevention. And we are very glad, Dr. Krasuski, that you agreed to speak to us and give us some tips about suicide assessment.
Yeah, well, thank you, Raj. I always like an opportunity to kind of spread the word about, you know, the things that we can do as clinicians to improve the way we assess people at suicidal risk and then manage them. Obviously, it's such a serious problem. We know that, you know, the suicide rates have been increasing now for the last 15 years or so. So this is a very timely topic. So thanks for the opportunity.
You talk, Jack, about the fallacy of prediction in relation to suicide. What do you mean by the fallacy of prediction?
Right, so there's a huge conundrum that we face as clinicians, and that is that we cannot predict suicide. By that I mean we cannot identify which individuals will proceed to die by suicide, and certainly we cannot predict when they will do it. And yet society at large kind of believes that we can predict.
Right.
And you know, malpractice plaintiff attorneys try to present to the court that we should be able to predict
suicide. For one particular person.
For one particular person. And yet the data does not support this. Over and over, the data shows that we cannot predict suicide, which individuals will proceed to suicide. And all the experts agree that this is not possible.
Right. So the clinicians shouldn't really put pressure on themselves, and we should try our best, but we should realize that it is not possible to be 100% certain for a particular patient whether this particular person will or will not commit suicide. You can never be 100% sure.
Yeah, you can never be 100% sure. And the reason for this is that because based on the how common suicidal risk factors are, and they're very common, and I'll give you some statistics just to highlight this point.
Yeah.
So suicidal risk factors are very common, and yet suicide itself has a low base rate. So to put it in a more provocative way, suicide is rare, while suicidal risk factors are common.
Right.
And it's really like trying to identify the needle in the haystack. So let me put this in perspective.
Yeah.
So in the year of 2014,
yeah,
there were 42,773 people that we know that died by suicide in the United States.
Okay.
42,773.
Right.
All right. Certainly a lot of people.
Yeah.
A large societal tragedy.
Too many.
And so now keep that number in mind, and yet at that same year there were about 1.1 million suicide attempts. So that means for every person who died by suicide,
yeah,
there were about 25 attempts.
Right.
Now we're not done. Epidemiological surveys in that same year suggest that 9.4 million people endorsed or had serious suicidal thoughts. 9.4 million. Yeah. That's over 220, you know, people endorsing serious,
right,
suicidal thoughts for every person who proceeds to suicide. So that's what I mean. The suicidal risk factors are very common. When you think about 9.4 million people, that's around 3% of our entire population.
Yeah.
9.4 million with, right, thoughts, 1.1 with attempts, and a little short of 43,000 who actually died by suicide.
Right. So it's hard to know out of the 10 million people which one of them is actually going to kill themselves.
That's right. And so, you know, a person can say, well, we can develop better instruments, you know, predictive instruments, you know, better rating scales or maybe some blood tests or, you know, brain scans or something like that. But I'm not very optimistic that in the near future we're going to really be able to identify which individuals will proceed to suicide. And the reason is because when there's a low base rate of a condition, the positive predictive value of any kind of instrument is going to be low. That means there will be many people who are false positives, and they will swamp the number of people who will be true positives, meaning the people who will then proceed to suicide. So it has to do, again, this conundrum of our inability to predict has to do with the commonality of the risk factors together with the low base rate of suicide itself.
So Jack, I want you to give like our audience a few like specific tips about what they can do to try to reduce, to assess suicidal risk and try to prevent risk. So let's give them some practical strategies that they can use. So like starting with the past, like, you know, in evaluating patients, we ask about previous suicide attempts and we get details of what the person did and so on and so forth. So in what way can we use that information to try to prevent future suicide attempts?
Yeah, so, you know, whenever I teach about suicide, the way I put it is, you know, when we are evaluating a patient who turns out to be at risk of suicide, and we're asking them, how are you, you know, what's going on now, what symptoms do you have, what risk factors do you have, protective factors, and then we talk about their past. Like, have you ever had suicide attempts in the past? Have you ever attempted suicide in the past? You know, I say it's not that we're asking this information because we're like writing a biography about the patient. You know, we have very, very concrete, very practical, important reason, and that is, if I could put it as a model, the past predicts the future.
Yeah.
Now, of course, nothing is ever perfect, but what we do, so when we start a suicide assessment, we focus on the present episode.
Yeah.
And there are two goals to assessing the present episode. First, we want to get an overall, ascertain the overall degree of risk. Is this person low risk, moderate risk, or high risk, or even like imminent risk, right? And based on that, you know, our kind of level of risk that we assign to the patient, that will lead to a disposition, to a decision on the level of care that the patient needs right now in order to protect them, to keep them safe. But the second goal is also that we are identifying the risk, the individual risk factors and individual protective factors, because the goal of management will be to address those directly. So we're not only treating a person for major depression and giving them fluoxetine, for example, we are doing that, but we're also going to target the individual risk factors and protective factors that can be targeted. Now, the way that the past comes in is then we have, perhaps for a lot of patients, many instances of either, you know, actual suicide attempts or times of previous crisis, even if it did not lead to a suicide attempt, where it was getting close.
Yeah.
And therefore, I want to identify the pattern over time of what are the warning signs
for that particular person.
For that particular person, the warning signs that are, you know, especially objective ones, that like my family, my friend, my psychiatrist can say, oh, so when you all of a sudden you're not sleeping, that's a bad sign.
Yeah.
Or all of a sudden when you stop, you know, whatever, visiting your grandchildren, that's a bad sign. So I'm using the entire history to identify the warning signs, meaning that the patient is going downhill, they're decompensating, they're falling into a crisis.
Yeah.
And then also I'm learning what the triggers are.
Again, they're different for different people.
They're different for different people.
So what are the triggers for this particular person?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember one patient I had whose suicide attempt was triggered by the fact that he was, you know, terminated from his job. And yet I remember, you know, that same week in my career, I had a patient who, you know, he for him losing a job was sort of like no big deal. Like you know, it's just so like, you know, either they're going to fire me, I'm going to quit, or I'm going to tell the boss he's an SOB. So, you know, it's in, you know, the triggers are going to be individual for that person. And I want to help them and myself to identify what they are. Now, for a lot of people, there are going to be like some interpersonal rupture. So, you know, a person who is, you know, their girlfriend or boyfriend breaks up with them.
Yeah.
Their spouse, you know, files for divorce. Some kind of interpersonal rupture or abandonment. And then often, especially if it's associated with like, you know, increasing intoxication during that time. So the person is despondent, they're intoxicated, and they may actually then...
So this is an example of triggers for one person.
That's right. So kind of like, you know, for that one person, it may be the combination of an interpersonal rupture together with, you know, getting intoxicated.
Okay.
It kind of like, you know, it increases their impulsivity and they go ahead.
I get it.
Yes.
So look for patterns, because the same pattern might repeat in the future.
Now, to kind of highlight, so everything from the past until the present moment that I'm meeting with the patient right now is I'm getting that information to help me decide the future. The upcoming future, like what's going to happen when this patient leaves my office?
Yeah.
So the very, like, you know, the very short-term future, but also the longer-term future. So for a lot of patients, they may come in to see me, and they have maybe a history of either, you know, suicidal crises or actual suicide attempts. Right now, they might be, you know, if I ask them, they might just say, no, I'm not having the suicidal thoughts right now. I'm not having any kind of plans. I'm feeling pretty good right now.
Right.
I will not stop there. I will then ask them to help me understand the future. So I'll say something like, well, what do you think it would take for you to get back into that bad place again where that crisis may reoccur or that you may want to, you know, you start thinking about taking your life? What would it take? And Raj, what amazes me is two things. How infrequently we as psychiatrists ask that question.
Yeah.
And the second thing that amazes me is how frequently patients just, they come up with an answer like this. It's like
they know.
They've been thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's almost like they've been waiting for someone to ask them this question.
Right, right. I've heard you refer to these things, the future assessment, as like hot button triggers.
Right, so
worst case scenario, end of rope scenario. Can you explain, like, what do these things
mean? Sure. So, you know, one way of phrasing that, like, you know, so what are your, you know, the hot button issues that can really hurt you?
The particular ones.
Particular ones that hurt you that may, again, trigger.
Yeah.
And I don't always say, you know, suicide attempts, but I say, you know, that will trigger these crisis times again for you, these much more difficult times for you.
Right.
So, and the patients can often say, well, yes, you know, again, if my girlfriend or boyfriend breaks up with me, or, you know, if I fail out of school, if I lose my job, and then I won't be able to pay my mortgage. So people can often, you know, identify those. Another way of putting it is worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And the way that I first became aware of this in my own practice was I had a patient who I'll call David. This was around 20 years ago, and he was a medical student. Brilliant guy, but, you know, he had schizoaffective disorder, and he was very, very odd in terms of interpersonal interactions. So the first 2 years of medical school, he did great because he was smart. The next 2 years, when he got into the, you know, on the floors, right, interacting with patients and attendings and nurses, and he just fell apart. He started acting very oddly. And so his psychosis was under control. He never, ever had any suicide attempts or any thoughts of suicide. But because of his odd behavior, he was placed on probation in the medical school. And the last time he saw me in the office, you know, I'd ask him, how are you doing, David? Fine, fine. And he, you know, I go over the psychotic symptoms, the mood symptoms, any kind of suicidal thoughts, nothing. And, well, here's your prescription for olanzapine. I'll see you next month, David. And he's like, oh, you know, do you know, I forgot to tell you, Dr. Jack, but in 2 weeks, I have a meeting with the probation committee, or whatever they're called, we're called in the medical school.
Yeah.
And I said, well, great. Well, good luck with that, right? So 2 weeks and a day later, I get a message that David had almost killed himself through a serious suicide attempt because the probation committee dismissed him from school. And I was thinking, like, you know, I was not thinking ahead. I was not future focused.
Yeah.
And yet that was a rather foreseeable
risk,
time of risk.
Yeah.
It may not have led to a suicide attempt, but it certainly would have led to a crisis in this man's life. I knew that this man had incredible interpersonal difficulties. And he told me that the probation committee was meeting with him. And I could guess that the three outcomes were, we're going to continue your probation, we're going to take you off probation so you're in good standing, or we're going to dismiss you.
Yeah.
So rather than asking, like, oh, David, hold on a second. Look, I wish for the best, but as your doctor, I'm paid to plan for the worst.
Yeah.
What's going to happen in the worst case scenario?
Yeah.
What if they dismiss you? And I don't know that what what he would have said, because that would be an alternative history.
Yeah.
But my guess is he would have known and said, Dr. Jack, I will have nothing to live for. Yeah. This has been my dream, my entire family's dream forever. Yeah. And if they dismiss me, you know, I may just want to kill myself.
Right.
I'll of course never know. But now from that case of David, I learned, assess the future.
Yeah.
Now we can't foretell the future, but we can at least some partially,
no, I
in
agree
a partial
with you.
Way,
yeah.
predict or, you know, try to foresee, maybe not suicide attempts, but times of crisis,
yeah, yeah.
that will then increase the risk of suicide.
Right, right. You make a great point that, you know, we are, usually when we say suicide risk assessment, we are thinking about risk in the next few days and trying to determine hospitalization, but you're saying, but also focus on long-term risk. But in assessing risk, Jack, like one of the problems we face is like most of the patients we see have many risk factors. You know, there are many different things. There are demographics, there are mental illness, there is interpersonal situation, and so on. So how should we think about these risk factors to make sense of it? Because simply listing all the risk factors is not really that helpful.
Yes, Raj, excellent point, excellent question. So when you read about, you know, suicide assessment, you will often see these lists. These are the risk factors. And you sometimes in some books, they will even kind of like put them in the table that you can kind of in a systematic go over them. And that's fine. And I think that's actually a good place to start. But then the question arises, okay, well, what do I do now?
Yeah.
So let me answer I have two things to say about it. Number one is, yes, go ahead and assess the risk factors. Number two, though, assess the protective factors. But when you do that, you're still left with a list of like all the bad stuff and
yeah.
all the good stuff.
Yeah.
And then like, okay, what do I do now? How does this list, you know, I've checked off certain things here. How does that translate into a professional judgment of like what I think the patient's risk is? So it's not like, oh, look, they have, you know, 10 risks that they endorse and only 3 protective factors, so
yeah.
oh, they must be at high risk. It's obviously not that simple.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like let's just weigh the, you know, like or count the number of risk versus protective factors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, every individual, you know, they will have some unique or personal risk factors. So, you know, when we talk about, when you see these risk factors in books, those are what you can call population-based risk factors.
Correct.
You know, male sex,
yeah.
You know, certain age, middle age or older age individuals, people who have had a suicide attempt in the last year. You know, there's different risk factors. Men, you know, having a psychiatric disorder obviously increases risk.
Yeah.
So there are these population-based risk factors, meaning like when you look at, when you compare people, when you do studies and you compare people who died by suicide versus those who didn't, those are risk factors. That means those people had higher rates of those factors.
Yeah.
And so those risk factors, they're associated with, you know, increased risk of dying by suicide.
So
but for every individual, they may, you know, they may have some very specific things that really drive the risk of suicide. For instance, like for someone who has a psychosis, their main driver of suicide may be that they have command hallucinations to
yeah.
die by suicide.
Yes.
Or maybe it's not so much that, but they have certain delusions. So I had a patient once who nearly killed herself, almost miraculous that she didn't. She had schizoaffective disorder, and she almost died because she took an electric carving knife. You know, we're talking right now like around Thanksgiving time, and you know, like the electric carving knives that you'd slice the turkey with.
Yeah.
She took it to her neck. You know.
Oh.
And I only became her doctor afterward when she
yeah.
made it on the psychiatric
yeah.
unit after like 4 weeks on the surge unit. And you know what she said? She said, because I was afraid that the mafia devils would torture me so horribly that I thought by killing myself, that was my only escape.
Yeah.
I'd rather kill myself than have them capture me
yeah.
and, you know, torture me horribly. Someone who is, you know, let's look beyond like someone with psychotic symptoms. So, you know, it might be someone with PTSD. So maybe their main driver is, let's say this was a soldier, you know, a veteran now, who, you know, his buddies just got killed, you know, in Iraq. They were driving in a you know, armored vehicle, and there was a bomb went off, and he survived and his buddies didn't. And he may be filled with incredible like guilt, survivor guilt. Like those guys were, you know, they were so much better guys than I was. I mean, they didn't deserve to die. It should have been me. You know, and then feeling an incredible amount of shame. Yeah. The quirk about human nature is that when we are victimized or traumatized, we often feel quite ashamed by it. Even though we kind of objectively have no reason to feel shame, we do. We often feel shame and guilt anyway. And so those may be the main factors, the main risk factors that for that individual, that veteran, drives his suicide risk. So, you know, so let me now segue to, you know, from assessment to management.
Yeah.
So when you identify all of these risk factors and protective factors, so number one, you know, I mean, speaking broadly, your goal should be to target these factors directly. Do what you can to bring down the risk factors.
Especially the drivers,
right? The most important ones, the ones that will most directly drive the risk of suicide. And then increase the protective factors.
Yeah.
And the protective factors are, for some individuals, when you speak to them, it may seem there are not many protective factors right now.
That does happen.
So I think another word to think about, in addition to protective factors, is think about the patient's resources. And the resources could be internal, like someone with a great kind of like a degree of resilience. You know, the life keeps pounding on them, but they kind of keep on going. You know?
Yeah.
High intelligence, for instance. Good distress tolerance skills. They could be external resources, a supportive family, the financial wherewithal to get treatment, right?
But what if there are not that many resources? Like, we see people who don't actually have too many resources right now.
Well, you know, I think that the good news is that there are always potential resources.
Okay.
So even if they're not existent, not present in the person's life right now, that we can deploy these resources that are not existent now. But we can, I mean, that's part of our jobs is to, you know, whether we implement the strategies ourselves or you know, send them to a therapist or a social worker to, you know, so there are plenty ways of thinking about potential resources. For instance, you know, I mentioned about distress tolerance skills. So for a lot of patients, they may be lacking certain kind of skills, coping skills, problem-solving skills, communication skills, negotiation skills, distress tolerance skills, emotional regulation skills. But the key word there is skill. People can learn things, learn how to do things, and we can teach them. In fact, of course, when we think about dialectical behavioral therapy, you know, one major component of that treatment is the skill groups. Right? Mindfulness skills, emotional regulation skills, you know, interpersonal effectiveness skills, which one did I miss? Emotional regulation, the stress tolerance skills.
Right, right. Great. So, you know, when let's say we assess a particular person and we looked at their past, we looked at their present, and we are trying to plan for the future, like anticipating, you know, what things could happen in the future and what protective things can be developed in the future. So that's a great way of looking at it. Sometimes we have these people where we're monitoring with suicidal ideation and we worry about them, and then the person doesn't show up for an appointment. Like, what would be your tip like for that? You know, it's anxiety provoking for the clinician that you have a person who has suicidal ideation and they didn't come today. So what would you do under such circumstances?
Right. I mean, all too often our patients miss sessions with us, And for some patients, you know, they may be, you know, having a milder form of generalized anxiety disorder. They miss a session. Maybe it's a business person, you know, who's, you know, kind of stuck Tokyo or something.
But
like
I worry that,
that
maybe the person killed
themselves. But there are some patients who we do worry about, because when they don't show up, it's just sort of like, are they in crisis? Are they like moving towards going down that suicide pathway? So we have to worry. So one of the things that I teach, a practical skill, and if I can kind of say, make a statement that's more broad, the way I talk about management of suicide risk, there I think about it in three levels. And this is just the way to organizing like a very complex management plan. So level one is optimized as foundational psychiatric management. Number two, as I kind of alluded to, is target the suicide-related risk factors and protective factors directly. Right. Level three is don't just treat the patient in the present, foresee the future, right? You have, you know, deploy the future-focused kind of treatment.
Yeah.
But anyway, so what you asked me now leads me to talk about, you know, just optimizing good foundational psychiatric management. By that I mean, this is what you should do for all of your patients, whether they're at suicidal risk or not. So one of the things that I have learned working with a lot of residents and doctors through my many years of doing the oral board courses is that I think there's much too little attention paid to the beginnings of the relationship, to the beginnings of the physician-patient relationship. And I think that a lot of the headaches that we actually experience as clinicians is because we don't take the time, often because we weren't taught to establish a strong foundation. So for instance, one of the things that is not paid attention to nearly frequently enough is establishing what's called a treatment contract or treatment agreement. Right? This is not the same thing as a treatment plan. It's a treatment agreement which lays out the parameters of treatment. Like, you know, these are my fees, and this is like, you know, if you want to cancel, you need to cancel, what, 24 hours before, 48 hours before? Otherwise, I'm going to charge you.
Yeah.
If you have me fill out forms, these are my fees. These are kind of my no-show policies. These are, in case of emergency, do this. Here's your, you know, patient bill of rights. So those setting up, you know, the foundation of the relationship. So in this treatment agreement, if I'm working with a patient that I'm already getting the sense that they are, you know, a more severely ill patient at high risk of suicide, I will customize that treatment plan. So for instance, every patient, you know, they have to give their emergency contact.
Right.
I'm going to call whoever you tell me, your mom, your dad, your spouse, whoever it is. But if someone is at high suicide risk, I might alter that and say, first of all, I want two emergency contacts.
Okay.
And then, because of like my kind of guess or anticipation of your increased risk, I'm going to regard you not showing up to a session as a potential emergency. So if you don't show up without canceling, you just don't show up and I don't know where you are, obviously I'm going to try to reach you first, right? But what if I still don't get a response? I'm like, I don't know what's going on with this person.
Yeah.
So in that case, you're giving me permission to call your emergency contact. Just by not showing up and not being in contact.
So plan this in advance, like get this agreement.
So much of this is about planning in advance, anticipating future problems and setting up the relationship and the treatment, you know, ahead of time to try to avoid some of these, you know, potential problems.
Terrific. Thank you, Jack. I mean, I think that it's a very nice way that you think about the suicide assessment and suicide prevention strategies as a continuum, like from the past to the present and then into the future, rather than only like what is going on right now and in the next few days.
That's right. We spend too little time anticipating, you know, what you know, potential crises that come up. Now, we're not fortune tellers. We can't look into the future, but that doesn't mean we can't use all of this data that we have from the patient and really, you know, at least you know, try to foresee the potential scenarios that can lead to future crises, and to recognize what the signs of decompensation are before the patient, you know, hits the crisis. Once there's a suicidal crisis, all bets are off. Things move so quickly.
Yeah.
There's an increased level of unpredictability. So our goal should be, number one, of course, we need to treat the patient right now in this upcoming day, week, whatever month. But we also need to anticipate the further off future. And our goal should be to help the patient avoid crises. And if we can't avoid them, to mitigate them. So, you know, there's one thing I wanted to add is what's called a safety plan. And this is not to be confused with the no harm contract. Okay, so no harm contract is like, Raj, you're my patient. You sign here that you agree not to try to hurt yourself or cure yourself while you're in treatment with me. Okay? Those don't work.
That's worthless. Yeah.
It's worthless. In fact, it could be counterproductive because it's just kind of, it gives people a false sense of security. That's not at all what I'm talking about. A safety plan is, so Raj, okay, so when you feel like you're in not doing well, or in your crisis, or you're really feeling kind of unsteady, like you're feeling like things may not go in the right direction, let's talk about what you can do in that time. So let me give you an example. I remember very well, I came up with a patient of mine who had was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And she would, very intelligent person, but she would often have these kind of crises she'd go into. And so then we worked out a plan. So number one, step one, like if I'm feeling bad, insecure, in crisis, whatever, bad, then number one, I will call my friend Mary. And I'd say, does Mary kind of understand about you, you know, about your kind of like, you know, inner thoughts and about your psychiatric, I mean, are you open with her?
Yeah.
And she'd say, yes, yes. And is Mary supportive of you? Yes, she is. Awesome. That's great that you have such a good friend.
Identify a particular person.
A particular person. All right. So you're going to call Mary. Okay. We're not done. We can't just have one step. So then I would say, so what if Mary is either unavailable, right? I mean, she has her own life. Or you talk to Mary, you get off the phone, and 5 minutes later, a half hour later, you're feeling really bad. It just didn't help enough. What are you going to do? What's step two? Well, and the patient was thinking about, I'm going to call my friend Anne. Great. Now, does Anne, are you open with her? Is she a good support? Yes, she is. Okay. Good. You're going to call Anne. Great. What happens if Anne's not available or it's not helpful enough? Well, I find that if I really like exercise, I move, that often helps quiet my mind and I feel better, and then I can kind of like, I get tired and I can go to sleep. Awesome. So what are you going to do? What do you mean exercise? Well, I'm going to go, I like taking a very brisk walk. You know, I have a nice park by my house. Awesome. And then even before I said anything, the patient said, but you know, as a woman, it's kind of dangerous for me to be out in this park after dark. I'm like, that's great thinking. You're thinking ahead. So you're going to go the brisk walk in the park, unless it's not a good idea. So what can you do then instead?
Have
step
a series
four.
Of coping skills that they
series
could
have coping.
Many
so then
options.
She said, well, I got a treadmill in my house. I don't really like that as much as walking, but that's still good. All right. What if that doesn't help? So eventually we got to the point where she had a PRN lorazepam. So if she did all those other steps, it was not enough, then she had my permission to take an extra lorazepam. Yeah. And of course, at the bottom of the list is like, you know, whatever, call me or go to the ER or something.
Call 911.
Yeah, call 911.
Of course. But that's not the only thing. Often the only
thing. That's at the bottom. That's like if all your coping strategies don't work, obviously you have to like, you know, maybe you need to end up in the hospital.
Right. Terrific. Thank you so much, Jack, for talking to
us.
Thank
you so much.
And all these giving us several very useful, actionable tips which we can implement in our clinical practices. Thank
you. Good. Well, you know, since you gave me this opportunity, I'm going to take this opportunity and tell you that, and your audience, that in 2017, I'm going to hold the second free suicide assessment and management course.
Okay,
great. Completely free.
Yes.
It's April 28th, 29th, 2017 in the Chicago area. Zero cost, 2 days. I invite everyone. and
April 28 and 29, 2017, right. In Chicago.
Yes.
And where can they go to find out about this or to register for the course?
It's on my website, Master Psych, one word, Master Psych, PSYCH.com, MasterPsych.com. And there's somewhere on the bottom there, or somewhere, I don't know, we're redoing it.
Yeah.
This is going to be the suicide course. We actually have an online version now for anyone who wants to kind of start right now. And I'm going to upgrade it and have a new expanded version also in April of 2017.
And can people assess this the online training at the same website, like for free? There's no cost?
There's no cost to anyone. So this is really, you know, I feel so strongly about this. And I also feel there's a need for further, you know, training and support of in our community of psychiatrists. You know, this is such a horribly, not only is this, you know, such a burden on our patients, but it's such a burden on us.
Right.
In fact, it's probably the number one source of stress among psychiatrists, dealing with patients who are at risk of suicide. So I think, you know, this is my way of giving back to the community. There's no obligation, there's no cost. You know, I just want to spread the word so we can kind of learn from each other and support each other.
Terrific.
So I appreciate this opportunity. You're giving me an opportunity to spread the word too. So thank you, Raj.
Thank you so much for doing that for our profession.
Thank you, Raj.